podcast, podcast, podcast.
Good day, podcast listeners, and thank you so much for listening. And we haven't thanked our 1776 Club supporters in a while, and we should never forget to do that. They make our lives worth living.
They have done so much to make it possible for this program to grow and gain confidence.
Keeping Graham busy all the time, and
he's doing an unbelievable job.
He really is.
I see things posted. He said, what Clay Jenkinson recently said, and I think, what? He's transcribing things. He's fixing things.
It's really fun. So thanks, Graham.
He's an amazing young man.
He is.
And you're lucky to call him your son, and he's my friend.
Yep. But this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, it's let's give Jefferson a migraine again and talk about the judiciary.
You worked him up into a passion today.
Well, you know, you said we needed to talk about the judiciary, and I can't help but be honest about it.
When I look at what's happening, did you watch some of the hearings?
Yes.
So they say, hi, I'm the senator from Connecticut. I want you to tell me what you would do if Roe v. Wade came up in some form. And then they say, I've never really thought about that, and I probably should not answer because I don't want to talk about any case that might or might not. And so this goes on for days, and you think, what have we learned here? So they're going to ask inappropriate questions that he can't possibly answer. He's going to avoid them. They're going to know. They showed this clip on one of the talk shows of Clarence Thomas back in the 1980s answering the question about Roe v. Wade. And he had been a law student at Yale when Roe v. Wade was decided. And he was asked by someone on the Judiciary Committee, when this happened, did you talk about the decision? And he said, no, I didn't. You know, everyone kind of, come on, you're a law student. The most important case in the history of reproductive rights or abortion, or however you want to put it, has now been decided by the Supreme Court in a highly controversial way. And you never, as a law student? And he said, no, I often stood by and watched others talk about it and took a great interest in what they had to say. But I myself like to withhold judgment and really just observe people when they debate. And no one in America believed this. The Senate didn't believe it. Clarence Thomas didn't believe it. The people who coached him didn't believe it. He was playing a role, we knew, which was a false one. And so you start your career on the court with a lie. They all do. It has nothing to do with Clarence Thomas. And the Senate knows that they're going to ask a question which can't possibly be answered. It's a silly process. And the senators do self-aggrandizing things. They grandstand. The nominees get increasingly, peevish in the face of these repeated questions.
And you maintain that this is not what Jefferson intended.
I'm closer to a modern view than Jefferson, which is these people are going to serve for 50 years. We'd better vet them carefully.
Well, and Jefferson said that he would be much happier if the judges were not appointed lifetime.
Lifetime tenure really bothered him, and some accountability is what he thought was necessary.
But they can hear that in the show.
But when we do it today, you have this kind of weird artificial process where the Democrats or the opposition party, whatever it happens to be, tries to rough the guy up and make him say something off the top of his head that he might not want to say, or her. And the candidates are very, very well disciplined and groomed. And so they say absolutely nothing at all. And then they get through the process. And then where are we? We don't really know anything more than we knew at the beginning. It's not a good process, is my point. And so Jefferson's view was, if you elect Trump and Trump says, I'm going to put people on who are pro-life, it's that simple, folks, period, then you know what you're voting for. Now, we don't know whether Gorsuch is pro-life or pro-choice or neither or something else, but Donald Trump said, I'm going to put originalists, I'm going to put people who don't legislate from the bench, whatever that means. He said, I'm going to put people who are pro-life. Folks, this is who I am. If you elect me, that's what I'm going to do. So it shouldn't surprise us that if he does that, and it's not for the Senate to say, no, we're going to hold you to a different standard. Elections matter.
Jefferson and the judiciary, it's kind of a timeless subject, and I'm saying that because you are soon to head to Montana for your annual Lewis and Clark tour.
And it's in July 18th through 27th.
Yep, go to jeffersonhour.com. You can find out more about that. But the reason I bring that
not
up is
too
that
soon, I hope.
We're doing a few shows ahead of time. And it.
Why? Just to get
just to have some stockpiles so when you're gone. Well, we know that this year Becky may drown you, so I'm trying to get a little
bit. I'm spending a lot of time in the barn. I'll just tell my listeners that. A lot of time in the barn right now.
Yeah. Anyway, so we've recorded this right at the tail end of March, and I only bring that up because by the time this airs, who knows what will have happened in the judiciary?
Anything can happen, although, you know, nothing scandalous has emerged about Neil Gorsuch. He's been extremely well-spoken. He gets high marks from the bar associations and from
those. But there's some Democrats that are still pretty upset about what happened to Merrick Garland, and with good cause. I mean, I've seen Republicans be very upset with Democrats for, well, why don't you just let him through? You know, that's what you – well – payback's kind
this,
of a
but this goose gander thing has to stop.
What goes around comes around.
You know, I'll say this, and I'm sure there will be people who dispute this, but on the whole, the Democrats are nicer to Republican nominees than Republicans are to Democratic nominees.
Boy, I don't know how you could ever say that and be sure of it.
I am sure of it.
Okay. Well, let's go to the show.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Becky Tour, July 18th through 27th. If this is your year, sign up now because we are delighted. This is my favorite trip of the year. You can go to jeffersonhour.com or clayjenkinson.com or audytours.net.
O-D-Y-tours.net.
But this, if you're going to come on this summer's tour, do it now because we're filling fast. And for me, this is the moment of moments of the calendar year.
So if you get enough people, will you be able to leave Becky at home then?
No. She always comes and she always tries to drown me. It's that simple.
All right, bye. Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author and creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. But seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good to see you, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
You are looking well, Mr. President. I trust all is well at your home.
It's always a pleasure to be in the fields, watching the young plants break through the surface of the red soils of the Southwest or Blue Ridge Mountains. And you cannot be a gardener or a farmer without feeling optimistic about the future.
I understand, Mr. President, that you would rise early in the morning.
At first light.
No one would see you until it was time for your breakfast.
I got up before the sun virtually every day of my entire life. I got plenty of rest, but when I could just barely see the hands of the clock at the foot of my bed in the first light of morning, I would spring up and go immediately to my writing table and write 2 or 3 or 12 letters and read perhaps. But I was an early riser. Of course, I also bathed my feet in cool water every morning as a way to stave off colds and fevers and agues.
I understand, Mr. President, that those in your family and within the household gave you your space. In other words, they knew better than to disturb you when you were at work in your office.
They gave it to me because I would have taken it if they didn't. An intellectual or a man of letters, as we would have put it, or a scientist, is someone who spends an enormous amount of time alone. You cannot be well-educated unless you read several hours per day. In my time, you could not keep up with the currents of the world unless you wrote and received letters. And this can only be done in privacy. I could write letters in a drawing room or a parlor if necessary. There were always little desks in the corner while other people would be playing cards or listening to the harpsichord or speaking, but to be a person who is intellectually alive and has read the great texts of Locke and Bacon and Newton and the classics, say, Cine and Thucydides or Tacitus or Cicero or Caesar for that matter, that person has spent a very large percentage of his time alone in a room with language and paper and books. And so I needed to protect that time. I wanted to write letters and receive them. This was my only way of staying with the world at so remote a place as Monticello. I was not, after all, in London or Philadelphia or even New York. But I also loved books so deeply that I can't imagine, I literally can't imagine my life without books being at the center of them.
Mr. President, it would seem to me that that kind of studying, that sort of discipline, as you put it, being a man of letters, would lead to good judgment. And it is judgment that I would like to speak to you about this week.
I'm not certain that deep reading leads to good judgment. I think the Creator, God, if you will, was a benevolent and wise being in that he gave us common sense. So there are people that have never read a book who have an extraordinary capacity with common sense. It's the tool we need most. You know, most people can smell hypocrisy. Most people can see through specious rhetoric. Most people can understand when their interests are being played with by a sharp operator or a demagogue. It's amazing how much basic good sense the people have, particularly when they come together. One person's judgment may fail for whatever reason, but put five in the room and the judgment is more certain. Put 500 in the room and you're pretty likely to get a good consensus of what a sensible response to the circumstances of life would be. So I trust the people because I think the Creator gave them the tool that they had to have. But I also believe that, you know, a great majority of people are willing to live just there, and they do all right. And it's not for me to question their happiness, but if you can stand on the shoulders of giants, if you can stand on the shoulders of Locke or on the shoulders of Francis Bacon or on the shoulders of Voltaire, Isaac Newton, you get to see what they saw, and to a certain degree you get to see more than they could have seen. That's why Newton made the famous statement, "If I have seen more than others, perhaps it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." I really believe that, and it's very hard in a democratic culture like ours to know how to formulate what I'm about to say. I don't quite pity those who don't have books, but part of me does, because I think that the richness of great literature, and particularly the richness of great nonfiction, reading Livy in Latin or reading the orations of Cicero or reading Plutarch's Life of Cincinnatus or his Life of Solon, or for that matter, reading fiction, Chaucer or Shakespeare or Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, these so enlighten and deepen and illuminate and clarify life that it's hard for me to understand why anyone who had access to that unlimited treasury of wisdom and insight and beauty would turn away instead to watch horse racing or to throw dice. And so I have a hard time, because I know that in democracy, freedom means that people have the freedom to make their own choices about what pleases them. I doubt, though, that we can be a republic for very long unless there is a good deal of civic engagement. And civic engagement requires good sense and some degree of formal learning, I think.
Mr. President, you talked earlier about your faith in the good judgment of people. I was surprised to hear that, pleased to hear it, and after some thought, I would agree with you, sir. However, I know that you were not so pleased with the judgment in the federal government. My understanding is that you were concerned about a government that was empowered to judge its own authority. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, there are a couple of things there. First of all, I trust people until they have power. And the minute they have power, I become suspicious. And you must become suspicious. So even the best man, let's say the putatively perfect man, a creature that's formulated by Aristotle or formulated by Plato or formulated by Newton and John Locke in concert, If you could create a perfect man who was virtuous and self-effacing and humble, wise, worked from evidence, open-minded, observed the world, did not let his ego get in the way of his capacity to make decisions, let's just assume that there is a perfect human being that could be constructed by good education. Give that person the authority of being a mayor or a governor or a senator, and that person is almost invariably going to become corrupted by it. That somehow when power comes to anyone, no matter how extraordinary an individual, that power brings with it some sort of an intoxication and some sort of a righteousness that can be really dangerous. And so I say, trust man until he has power, and then bind him under the very narrow leash of constitutional protocols and due process, because if you don't, even a man as great as George Washington, I hesitate to speak in this way of so great a man, but even someone like George Washington becomes a little thin-skinned and a little self-righteous and a little arrogant about the way he looks upon those who disagree with how he sees the world and the decisions that he has made.
If I could quote your own words, Mr. President, later in your life, in 1819, you wrote to a Judge Spencer Roan, and you said, "The Constitution is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they may please." That sounds as if you had not settled your feelings about the judiciary later in your life.
Well, that's a different subject, related but different. So we have a Constitution, and our Constitution rightly understands that the people are sovereign, that in my time there were 6 million Americans, so let's use that. Those 6 million are America. They are the sovereign. It's their country. They are free to do with it what they please. It's not for somebody on the outside to look in and tell them who they should be and how they should behave. If you believe in the sovereignty of the people, then you must trust that the people have a right to make their own public choices. And I know this sounds like a paradox, but it comes from Rousseau. I'm not a big fan of Rousseau, but Rousseau said the people are right even when they're wrong. In other words, the people have the authority to determine their own destiny, even if from some lunar perspective, they're making bad choices. And so if that's the case, if we agree on the basic premise of modern life, that the people are sovereign, then the people create a government. The people decide how they're going to adjust their social relations, and they create a system of juries and evidence and how to pass a law and how to enforce laws, how to gather a sense of the will of the people, under what conditions we have elections and so on. The people come together as the Founding Fathers did in Philadelphia in 1787, and they create a social compact. They create a formal system of procedures and protocols, which they call their constitution. And then once it's ratified, they agree to live according to that instrument, according to those procedures. And so we did that. Well, if the people are sovereign, then you need to create a system which listens to them carefully and tries to apply their will in the public square. If you do that, you are going to produce happiness. If you find ways to deny the people their own sovereignty and are constantly turning to experts, or what Mr. Hamilton called the wise, the rich, and the well-born, then you're not really believers in the sovereignty of the people. You don't really trust the people, and you're constantly putting up a barrier between them and their desires, their intentions for the country. And so I judge a constitution according to whether it fulfills the will of the people. The Supreme Court, or any court system, therefore, sitting in splendid isolation, is suspect under this system of understanding sovereignty.
Mr. President, there's much to respond to. There are many questions that I would like to ask you about the judiciary. We're going to take just a short break. Perhaps I can present them to you when we return.
Of course, sir.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. This week we're having a conversation with President Jefferson about the judiciary branch of our government. Mr. Jefferson, we have three branches of government, and there are checks and balances that affect each of those three branches. Shouldn't there be one branch that has a final say?
Yes, and that should be the legislative branch.
Over the courts?
Yes, because the legislative branch is elected by the people. The courts, as you know, they consist of people who are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And once they are confirmed by the Senate, they serve for life. They have life tenure on good behavior. And that means that they never have to face the electorate again. If I'm a representative from the state of Virginia, and I vote to triple taxes for the nation, 2 years later, the people will go back to the polls and they will decide whether they want to confirm that or repudiate me. And they have the right at that moment to send me back into private life because I have raised taxes beyond their endurance, or I have not listened to what I call the decided will of the people, or I have engaged in some sort of corrupt practices and they believe that I'm no longer really their agent. But if I am a legislator, especially in the House of Representatives, I have to face the sovereign every second year. And that gives them an opportunity to repudiate me if I fail to be an honest agent. If I'm a member of the U.S. court system, whether it's a circuit court, an appeals court, or the Supreme Court, once I have been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, I serve for life, and never again in my life do I have to face the sovereign. I'm immune unless I commit high crimes and misdemeanors. And as I will tell you, there has never been a successful impeachment of a Supreme Court justice in all of American history to your own time. So that body does not actually represent the people. At its best, of course, it will try to do so. But there's no recourse when a justice of the Supreme Court begins to favor one faction over another, or one class of people over another, or to engage in his own private view of what the government or the country should be. There needs to be accountability, and the people need to have the chance to retire those who are not serving them well.
Mr. President, I detect a bit of tension in your voice. Are you comfortable continuing with this conversation, sir?
It's very upsetting to me because I do honestly believe that the people are up to the challenge and that the people are sovereign, and that in an ideal world, there wouldn't be a House and a Senate. There would just be a House of Representatives. There would be some sort of National Assembly. And the people who go there would be faithful agents of their constituents.
Granted, Mr. President, and I believe you. However, with all due respect, sir, it sounds as if you have, a bone to pick with the judiciary. Could it have anything to do with Chief Justice Marshall?
Well, there is, of course, Marshall, but it's not personal. So it is true that Marshall was my cousin.
But it is upsetting you, sir.
He did not like me, and I did not like him. I think he had lax, lounging, tavern sorts of manners, and he thought that I was a Jacobin, that I was kind of a political idealist and radical. And he was a Federalist and a friend to other Federalists like Rufus King and Timothy Pickering, but particularly to John Adams. And it was Adams in the last moments, literally, in the last discredited moments of a failed one-term presidency, when the results of the election had already come to him, when it was clear that the American people had retired him and repudiated him and engaged in what I like to call the Second American Revolution. Adams was not only a lame duck, but he was on the way out. And the people had spoken emphatically that they rejected his leadership, and in the last days and hours of his discredited administration, Adams put as many people into our court system as he could who were sworn enemies to my vision of this country, who were personal enemies in some cases, whose mission was to prevent me from bringing about the changes that I think the people were asking me to bring about after the election of 1800. And to do that, these are called the midnight appointments. All historians call these the midnight appointments because some of them were literally appointed in the last hours of the last day of the Adams administration. To do that when it was clear that the American people had emphatically determined to go into a different direction and to place into the court system people who were my known and sworn enemies. And one of them, my cousin John Marshall, that was the only thing that Adams ever did that offended me deeply. We had our differences about the nature of government and so on and so forth, the French Revolution and whether we needed a unicameral system or a bicameral system and whether commerce was more important than agriculture. And you know, we were great friends and we had many principled disagreements. And as I always like to say, we disagreed as rational friends. But when he made his midnight appointments designed to prevent what I call the Second American Revolution, that I think was a deeply abusive thing for him to do. I did forgive him, of course, but that was difficult.
Well, Adams had the right to do that as a president.
That's what his wife said. She said, up until the moment that he leaves power on the 4th of March, 1801, he's the president.
So in my time, Mr. President, we have a situation that may be of interest for you to comment on. The previous administration, sadly, one of the Supreme Court justices passed away. The president produced a new nominee, and the opposition party refused to even consider this man because they felt it was too close to a new president coming into office, and it's still a point of contention.
Right. So there are different degrees here. So there are two things to say. One is that these midnight appointments of Adams were literally in the last days of his administration.
What is an appropriate amount of time?
Well, that's a good question. Is it 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years? I think that you could stretch this to any form of self-interest that you might wish. That's one issue. And the second issue is that when your current previous president nominated a certain person to the court, the election had not yet come. In other words, it wasn't clear how the American people were going to vote. But in the case of John Adams, the people had spoken emphatically and unambiguously. That's different. I will say this, sir, that when I was in my last year of the presidency in 1808, and it was clear that I was going to retire in the spring of 1809, I did not make any strong decisions that might hamstring my successor. Now, I reckoned that my successor would be James Madison, my Secretary of State, but there was no guarantee of that. The other person might have won. But I did nothing that would bind my successor months ahead of time, even though I had a pretty good sense that my closest friend was going to be my successor. That's the way it should be. The outgoing president, when he feels that it's a little bit too close to the new inaugural, he should withhold making decisions that would make it more difficult for the next president to work freely according to his own political vision. On the other hand, some things are extremely important, especially in your time where the pace of life moves many magnitudes faster than it did in mine. These are questions of judgment. I will say this, though, that the fact that your President Obama's appointment came while he was still president and an election had not come, not by months, is different from Adams appointing people when the election results were clear and nobody disputed them in the United States.
Mr. President, I want to be clear in understanding you. We have three branches of government. I just want to be clear on what you think the appropriate amount of power is for each one.
Easily done. So the legislative should be supreme because it's the branch that leans on the people, and of the two houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives, the House should be supreme because it's the one that's reelected every second year. There are more of them. They have actual constituents, not virtual constituents. In my time, the Senate was elected by the state legislatures, and so there's a direct election of congressmen, of representatives, but in my time, an indirect election of senators. And so of the two branches of the legislative branch of government, it should be the House of Representatives that is supreme. And that's true, especially on questions of money and war. Senate second. The executive branch proposes possible legislation to the legislature, and and enforces and applies legislation once it has been passed. If the president determines to sign it, he can veto, of course, and his veto can be overridden by two-thirds of both the House and of the Senate. But the president makes broad proposals for the country. He provides an annual State of the Union address of some sort, or at least a report. He makes policy suggestions. He conducts foreign policy. He makes appointments to the courts and so on. But his role is an administrative one, much more than it is a legislative one, and the president needs to yield to the legislative branch, which should be supreme. And then the third branch of government, the judiciary, should be the weakest, the least, and the most humble. And my view is that they should not have the power of judicial review. They have the power of judicial review because of Chief Justice John Marshall, who in a famous case, Marbury v. Madison in 1803, traveled out of the case and said that the Supreme Court of the United States would determine what is and what is not constitutional. When he made that decision, the famous case Marbury v. Madison, Justice Marshall was not operating from within the Constitution. If you read your Constitution once or 1,000 times, you will never find the concept of judicial review there. In other words, the men who created the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787, wise men, the greatest collection of genius ever, did not install into the new constitutional system judicial veto. That was imposed upon the Constitution in Marbury v. Madison by Justice Marshall. If he had been a better master of the law, he would not have done that, and you've been stuck with it ever since.
How do you think things would be different if that had not happened?
I think that the judicial branch should have original jurisdiction in a few cases, and they do, and they should be the court of highest appeal, and they are. But in terms of constitutionality, if the legislature passes a law which the courts find to be in violation of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, then the court should say, we've studied this pretty carefully, and it's our best opinion that the Congress has violated the First or the Fifth or the Eighth Amendment or whatever it is, and we strongly urge you to reconsider. In other words, the court should have judicial advice. They should be a cadre of wise judicial masters who should make suggestions to the executive and to the legislative branches that are non-binding, powerful, morally important, and to be respected, but not binding, so that then the legislature will say, well, the Supreme Court has said that it believes that this tariff law violates such and such a clause of the Constitution. We trust these men. Let's rethink it. Let's look again and make sure that we're not doing something dangerous here.
It seems to me, Mr. President, that that could get very complicated without a perhaps it's a product of me living in the modern times.
Let me say two things to you, sir. First, the only way your system works that the Supreme Court has judicial veto is if the Supreme Court is always made up of extraordinarily wise, virtuous, careful, thoughtful, constitutional men and women. In other words, you are positing some sort of court that never existed, because I can assure you that justices of the Supreme Court or other judges are men like other men. They have strengths and weaknesses. They have blind spots and prejudices. They have silly ideals. They're swept away by fanaticism. They have good days and bad. They get sick. They get weary. They are capable of bribery, of corruption.
Careful, Mr. President. You're defeating your own argument.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that if you wanted judicial veto, you would have to erect some Olympian body of perfect judicial masters who never could be swayed by self-interest or personal prejudices, and that has never been the case. And the Romans understood this. The Romans said, yes, we need guardians, but who will protect us from our guardians? If you want guardians, they must be perfect men. They almost never are. That's number one. And number two, why should nine in your time, six in mine, why should nine unelected, unimpeachable, people who never have to stand again for a reaffirmation from the American people, sitting in splendid isolation, why should those nine individuals have veto power over acts that are distilled from, in your time, 330 million Americans, in my time, 6 million Americans. Why do those nine unelected officers who never have to face their constituents again for the rest of their lives, why should they have superior power to determine the uses of our Constitution and its appropriate interpretation over the sovereign itself, the people, as expressed through their legislative process?
I hesitate to challenge your argument, Mr. President, but earlier in the conversation, you said that if we had five citizens making a decision, that was good. If there were 50, that was better. Or if there were 500, that would be even better.
Yes, diffusing power.
So what you're saying is that through some chain of events, in my time, these nine justices who are in place have become less than average citizens, and you give them not that credit.
I don't, because they sit in splendid isolation. They don't have to go mingle with their constituents.
But you see my point, sir.
I see the point, but I don't agree with it. It seems to me that you are talking about a world that does not exist. I want the people to be sovereign, and if the people are sovereign, then they must make their own choices. And the whole genius of the judicial branch is that you want your judges to be independent of popular political maneuvers and moments to a certain degree. You want them to be independent of the dynamics of any given moment in America's political life, of course. Otherwise, they can't be good justices. But you don't want them to be absolutely independent, because then they don't have to listen any longer. And so finding that balance between making them independent enough to make the right choices and not to be pressured by the politics of the moment, but making them dependent enough so that they don't simply become tyrants of the court, that's the whole genius of this. And I'm afraid I feel that the Constitution itself was better than it became after Marbury v. Madison, when Justice Marshall, my cousin, imposed upon the Constitution an alien concept of judicial review. In other words, it's not the Founding Fathers' fault, although they might have clarified this a bit. It's Marshall's fault, and the fact that you continue to wait every spring, as you do, for the Supreme Court to make its pronouncements, where these nine individuals decide the destiny of one of the greatest republics in the history of the world, a nation of a third of a billion people, is not only anti-democratic, it's appalling. It's a violation of the very principles of the United States. And I repeat, it is not a power granted to them by the Constitution of the United States or ratified by the people.
Were they not given lifetime appointments? Would that satisfy you, sir?
Yes. If they had to face a vote of confidence or no confidence every 5 or 10 or 15 years, I would be much happier.
Well, that seems like a fairly simple solution. Couldn't Congress pass that?
No, Congress couldn't, but the people could insist upon either a constitutional amendment or a new constitution of the United States that would find some limit. And let me say this, too. In my time, if a person was appointed in his 50s, he was dead within 10 years. In your time, if you appoint somebody in his 50s...
Sir, you live to be 82.
And that's very rare. Someone appointed in his 50s could be on the courts for 50 years. That's two generations of American life.
Mr. President, I thank you for a difficult conversation. I always hesitate to bring up these issues, but I do appreciate your candor and your insight.
I have a migraine headache, but I'm glad we've had this conversation.
Perhaps we can talk gardening next time, sir.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. When we return, we'll be speaking with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And seated across from me now is the gentleman who created the Thomas Jefferson Hour and portrays President Jefferson, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And I'm afraid I might have given Jefferson another migraine.
This is a fun subject. It's, of course, it's
not for him, it isn't.
But I've actually performed as Jefferson before most of the members of the Supreme Court.
Really?
Not necessarily the current members, but the last group.
Drop a few names here.
Well, Byron White
and Antonin
Scalia and
you actually performed in the White House for President Clinton.
I did.
And you were barely recognizable. You were such a young.
I was a child.
You were 14 or
but
something.
But Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Really?
Yeah. It's been Sandra Day O'Connor, and they've questioned me as Jefferson. It's been fun because, as you see, Jefferson has this kind of wonderful. Radical
Boy, I'd
view
love to,
of the
I'd
courts.
Love to get a hold of one of them and get him on the show to question you again.
You should do that. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she once asked me, and this was in the Ninth Circuit, I think, out in California. She said, Mr. Jefferson, I mean, do you think women should be on the Supreme Court? And I got to say to one of the most powerful women in the world, someone I deeply admire, I got to say, Madam, the tender breasts of ladies were not formed for political convulsion. And she guffawed because she said that's—
I'd love to see a photo of that.
She did. She guffawed because she knew that's how Jefferson saw it. But she's amazing. And now she's trying to hang on for whatever it is, 4 years or 4 months, whatever it's going to take. But anyway, it's fun to perform for judicial audiences because, of course, they all believe that Marshall was right. They all believe that our salvation has been judicial review. And many find this—
Well, it's, you know, you do a very good job portraying Jefferson because I know you don't necessarily believe him, but you always allow Jefferson's cool and calm persona to melt a little bit when this subject comes
up. Well, Hamilton, and there are four or five subjects where Jefferson gets kind of worked up.
Did he get to appoint any Supreme Court justices?
Yes, he did. Three of them, as a matter of fact. And at the time, there were— Six members of the court, not nine.
I was
going
to ask you that, too. Most people think there's always been nine.
Nothing magical about nine. In fact, FDR tried to raise it to 12 because he was trying to pack the court with his own people. But Jefferson's appointees, William Johnson of South Carolina, that was in 1804, Henry Brockholst Livingston from New York, the famous Livingston family, November of 1806, and Thomas Todd of Virginia, in 1807.
Let me guess, they were all Jeffersonian Republicans, right?
They were, but several of them disappointed him so that, you know, he's constantly writing them and saying, hey, I appointed you. I expect you to be a good small-R Republican and to—
I kind of have a theory about that. When judges are appointed to the Supreme Court, some sort of switch flips, just like a candidate when he becomes president, that most cases, the power, weight, respect— history of the office has an effect on them. Do you think I'm just being naive?
I won't pause to talk about most cases in the presidency, but yes. So what happens is that, let's say you're 40 years old and you're a woman or a man and you're appointed to the court and you're confirmed by the United States Senate. Short of committing actual crimes, you're there for the rest of your life.
Or until you quit.
Almost nobody retires at 70 or 65, that people hang on. And so you have this, what we call it, life tenure. It's a wonderful thing, David.
It can work both ways.
But
right?
it's wonderful because that person can decide who she or he is going to be, and there isn't a darn thing that the person who appointed them can do about it. And oftentimes, in case of Jefferson, he's very careful about these things. He's a master of administration. He appoints three people to the court, and two of them disappoint him pretty considerably in the course of their tenure because, first of all, they get to see what we don't. You know how very complex these questions are. No easy question ever gets to the Supreme Court. This is what's good about judicial independence is that these people are allowed then, because they're protected and they're protected for life, they're allowed to evolve and develop in the ways that they feel right. And it would be harder if they were under some sort of a political tether for them to be independent.
I get that, but whenever I speak to the president about these issues, he gets quite wound up and he comes down very hard on one side of this. Why is that? Why was it such a personal thing to Jefferson?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, John Adams started it by the midnight appointments. And really, you can say that, as Abigail Adams did, that, hey, he had a right to appoint anyone up until the last moment of his—
And he did.
But you can see why that would sit badly with Thomas Jefferson, particularly given the fact that John Marshall, his enemy, was placed in the position of being Chief Justice.
Let's talk about Adams and all this. Where does he, what sort of blame do you lie on him?
Both directions. So on the one hand, he's perfectly right, as Obama was, to appoint anyone he pleases as long as he's
president.
Yeah,
but he was angry at Jefferson and getting even with him, right?
Right. But he also was a principled person who thought Jefferson was a dangerous man, and so he's trying to protect the country by putting into the judicial branch people who will protect the system from Jefferson. So, you know, people that of his political persuasion would say, thank goodness he placed those midnight appointments in. Otherwise, who knows what Jefferson might have done with America. So you can look at this in both directions. But I do agree with Abigail Adams. He had a legitimate right to appoint anyone he pleased. There's a little something undignified about the kind of hugger-mugger last second, midnight's coming, can we get it done nature of some of this. But he's within his constitutional rights. She is correct about that. As a friend of Jefferson, you sort of think that he might have been willing to be more accommodating, particularly when the people had discredited him. You know, I don't really know what to think about that. Jefferson took it ill. But that's the first reason why Jefferson gets so worked up about this. The second reason is, and this is more personal, but he couldn't stand it that John Marshall was a fellow Virginian, but he was a Federalist. Jefferson's view was that all Virginians, of course, are Republicans. A Virginian who's a Federalist has committed treason against Virginia because you're supposed to be an agrarian Republican
so
if you're...
It's not really Jefferson's brightest, best moment.
I'm not so sure about that because look what Marshall did in Cohen's versus Virginia in a whole series of cases. Marshall laid down a centralization of the federal government. In other words, the government was born in the Constitution and in its ratification. Then in a series of decisions between 1801 and 1832, Justice Marshall, one of the longest-serving chief justices of the Supreme Court, decided again and again and again and again on a stronger, more centralized, more powerful national government, weakening states in the process. In some sense, he is using his power on the court to change the nature of the United States Constitution.
Well, he was a Federalist. He had more faith in that form of government.
But Jefferson's question is a legitimate one, David. Why does one extremely talented individual get to change the whole nature of the Constitution of the United States?
Oh, I don't know. Fate?
It is fate. But
I go back to Jefferson when I questioned him. He had that eloquent speech, you know, five citizens and 500 would even be better. Well, we have nine citizens making decisions. And I wasn't really satisfied with his answer.
Really? What was his answer?
His answer was, yes, but they're appointed and they're different than an average citizen.
Well, that's certainly true.
It was kind of a dance. Let's take your argument literally, Mr. President.
Justice Scalia, in a moment of candor before he died a few years ago, said, we don't pal around with the real people. We hang out in the best resorts. We meet the most privileged people. We're a special breed. We don't. The people is a whole different thing from us. We're really an elite that we hang out with fellow elites like ourselves. When he said that, he confirms the worst fears that Jefferson has of these people.
But that is one man. Now, I'm going to say to you, you know, you've admitted you live a pretty charmed life. Do you really think that you've, at your core, changed from that kid who sat in his basement listening to the Beatles when he was 14 in Dickinson, North Dakota?
Well, first of all, I put my tights on one leg at a time.
sorry to drag your personal life into this, but I think it's
course.
A good question. Have your core values really, really changed? Are you still that guy?
Yes and no.
Older and wiser.
Well, but also you do become detached from... I took my daughter to a ranch. I have a close friend, couple that have a ranch about 60 miles from Bismarck. And this ranch couple has three extraordinary daughters, rodeo, 4-H, you name it. They're like ideal Americans. And when the dinner was over, their mother just kind of glanced up and they all popped up and they went and started doing the dishes and did their chores. There was no, I'm going to go watch television for a while or I'm not doing your chores. These were like the politest, nicest, best developed young people you could ever meet. So we have this extraordinary time and we go out to the rodeo arena and they're doing all this stuff that's amazing. We got back in the car. My daughter was studying at Columbia at the time and I stopped the car about 5 miles from their ranch and I said, if you ever forget where you came from, I will be so critical of you, you came from a town like this. You grew up in 4-H. You were a volunteer. You understand what rural life looks like. You know that most people in America are not privileged. If you ever, ever forget where you came from, I will be so disappointed in you that I will be unrelenting in my criticism. And she looked at me and said, you too.
That's great.
But that was right. I pride myself on being a Rhodes Scholar from North Dakota, and both of those terms are of equal weight to me.
So I have kind of snuck your personal life into this, and I'm not even going to apologize for it. But my point is that I believe in people's core character values. You know, that may be Scalia's view, but it might not be anybody else's. Scalia may have succumbed to that.
You know, they all do it.
Or am I naive again?
Well, look, I'll turn it on you as long as we're at this game. You're about as grounded.
You're breaking up, you know.
Yeah, you're as grounded and humble a person as I've ever met, and it's because you've never forgotten. That's what I love about you, and that's what I love about North Dakota. And that, frankly, is why I'm so worried about the future of rural America and North Dakota, because when we grew up, that was North Dakota. When someone died, suddenly the doorbell rings and people are bringing casseroles and roasts and potatoes and bread.
It's a good little petri dish on what economy can
we do. We were once an extraordinary and Jeffersonian place.
You used to say that.
We were, and now we've let some of it go. Part of it's modernity. Part of it is the connectivity of the internet world. Part of it is the Walmartification of the world and Costco and so on. But part of it is forgetting who we were. And we mustn't. That's why I live here and not Minneapolis or Denver or San Francisco or Portland. I live here because there is a groundedness here. You have it. The people who really understand what life is get this. And the people who forget it should not be allowed to be at the levers of power.
As to quote another pop song, excuse me, money changes everything. And to quote a gentleman who lives out in McKenzie County who I have so much respect for, government exists in one form or another to prevent chaos, not encourage it. And I think that's what's happened in North Dakota is we've seen great economic development, and it's changed things a lot. And government has not prevented chaos. But, sir.
It's not about North Dakota, although that's where we live, but I choose to live here for those things. And I've been disappointed with where North Dakota's heading. And one of the things that I so admire about our current governor, Doug Burgum, who's new, he's kind of the Steve Jobs of North Dakota.
Reaching out to people.
He believes that the strength of North Dakota is in the small towns, which I do too. They're a little clunky, but they're magnificent. He believes that we must repair Main Street in rural America or there's no point in living here, and he's listening. And he's particularly listened to Native Americans more than any governor in North Dakota history.
Which in this climate is a tough thing to
do. He has been governor now for a few months, and more than any governor in North Dakota history, he has listened to Native Americans. And not like, I'll let you say four sentences so I can hold forth for a while. He goes to the reservations, and he knows they're different. Ojibwe are not Dakota, are not Mandan, are not Hidatsa, are not Arikara. He goes and he listens for hour after hour after hour, and I know that you have to get weary of that, but he never ceases to listen.
It's a tense environment for that.
But I love that, because if you believe that rural America matters, which I do, if you believe that the agrarian model that Jefferson had in mind with all of its changes has been the strength of places like North Dakota and is one of the continuing strengths of America, then you want to protect family farms. But you also need to understand that unless you are good to the least of them, you cannot be good for all of them. And Theodore Roosevelt understood that. Jefferson certainly understood that. These are very, very important principles.
Clay, thanks for a wonderful conversation, an enlightening conversation, Jefferson and the judiciary. I enjoyed it very much. But now, sir, we must leave that conversation because it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
By the time you hear this, the Senate of the United States will probably have confirmed Neil Gorsuch as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Whether you like him or not, his appointment would be good news for America, I think, and would return us, if only briefly, to Jefferson's reading of the United States Constitution. Elections matter. Because of that, according to Jefferson, the President of the United States is entitled to surround himself with men of his own political stamp. Jefferson believed that the Senate's proper constitutional role in these situations, to advise and consent, is not to determine whether it likes the judicial philosophy of the nominee or his politics, or whether they might have preferred somebody else. The Senate's role, as Jefferson understood it, was merely to determine whether the nominee is fit for the office. Jefferson believed that if the president nominates a lightweight, the Senate should decline to consent. But if the candidate is qualified, the duty of the Senate is to consent with the president's wishes. Elections matter. When you vote for president, you are also voting for his cabinet, his White House staff, his level of enforcement of the laws on the books, indeed for his likely executive orders, and for his or her nominations to the U.S. court system, including the Supreme Court. That's how things were, more or less, until President Reagan's nomination of Robert Bork in 1987. Bork was a brilliant, brash, arrogant, outspoken jurist with a take-no-prisoners attitude and a record of not being very sympathetic to the rights of women and minorities. Soon enough, however, Anthony Kennedy was nominated for that seat and confirmed without fanfare. Kennedy has been an extremely important centrist and swing vote on the court for 30 years. Since the Bork debacle, the Senate has played an increasingly partisan and meddling role in the filling of Supreme Court positions. Most candidates still move pretty comfortably into their life-tenured positions, but they all get roughed up more than the founders intended, ask pointless questions about litmus tests and hypothetical future cases that they are now perfectly groomed not to answer, and a few, like Clarence Thomas, subjected to what his detractors regarded as a well-deserved ordeal, but he famously characterized as a high-tech lynching. Elections matter. I feel that it is time to swing the pendulum back towards Mr. Jefferson's view that it is not the Senate that appoints judicial officers, but the victorious President of the United States. What the Republican Senate did to Merrick Garland was, in my opinion, obscene and unconscionable. I hope the Democrats in the Senate have behaved more responsibly towards nominee Gorsuch. Jefferson objected strenuously when his predecessor, John Adams, packed the federal court system in the very last days of his administration with high Federalists who disliked Jefferson politically and personally and who made it their mission to prevent him from making any radical adjustments to the American Republic. Who knows what kind of justice Gorsuch will be? My point is that justices once installed frequently turn out to be wonderfully independent of the men who appoint them. President Dwight D. Eisenhower said, if we can believe the story, "I've made only two mistakes as president, and both of them are on the Supreme Court." I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.